WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. School segregation has been unconstitutional since 1954, but America's schools are slipping backward toward the increasing isolation of African American and Latino students. Most people who think desegregation is a nice ideal assume that nothing can be done. The civil rights impulse from the 60s is dead in the water. These are some of the conclusions of a recent report by the Harvard Project on School Desegregation conducted for the National School Boards Association. My guest, Gary Orfield, is the director of the project. He's often testified in Congress and in the courts on issues of education and race. Gary Orfield, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
So why do you think that schools in America are going backwards?
Well, lots of different things contribute. One of them is simply we have more minority students and fewer white students as a share of our population. And our residential settlements of African Americans and Latinos are growing and taking up more and more of the space in big cities. And we don't have desegregation remedies that reach effectively across the city's suburban boundary lines. Another one is nothing's been done to update many of the desegregation plans that exist as the demography changes. Still another one is we're dismantling some of our desegregation plans. The Supreme Court, in a couple of very important decisions in Oklahoma City and DeKalb County, Georgia, has provided guidelines that enable lower federal courts to dismantle desegregation plans under some circumstances. So some of them are being intentionally dismantled, and we're returning to segregation neighborhood schools as a matter of policy preference by local school districts and approval with local federal courts.
I would certainly guess that one of the reasons why schools are becoming more segregated is that a lot of the white middle class is moving or has already moved out of the cities to the suburbs. And a lot of the white middle class and I think a lot of the black middle class as well are sending their children to private schools or religious schools.
Well, one of the things we looked at in the report was how does the distribution among public and private schools compare with what it was a generation ago? We actually found that the perception that whites were going to more and more private schools wasn't true, that actually there's been a decrease, a small decrease in the share of white students who go to private schools in the last generation. And the reason that people believe that's true is because the proportion of whites in public schools has gone down significantly, but that relates to the differential birth rates of the overall population. The growth of our population is now primarily Latino, and we're building a different society, and we oftentimes misperceive what things are going on. Now, there are some cities, of course, where whites did leave the public schools in substantial numbers during the beginning of the desegregation process. And, of course, in almost all of our central cities, there's been a steady outward migration of white middle-class families, whether or not there's been a desegregation plan ever since World War II. Right now, the big migration out from the central cities isn't the white middle class. It's been gone from many of our central cities for quite a while, at least the white middle class with children. We're seeing a very substantial migration of the black middle class and Latino middle class into different sectors of suburbia.
I think that a lot of the desegregation plans that were previously put into effect relied on busing. I think the popular opinion of busing is that it was a real failure. Would you agree with that perception?
No. Busing is just a way to get kids to school. Busing was implemented, namely assigning kids to school outside their neighborhoods where transportation would be required. It was implemented in hundreds of school districts in the early 1970s. It was implemented in a very bad and ineffective way in some school districts. Those tended to get the most publicity. It was implemented quite successfully in many other school districts. And I think it's like any other policy. It's not a perfect policy. On average, it works reasonably well. We know how to make it work better. And most people whose children have been bused to school under desegregation plans think it is a success. Both whites and black families have said that in a number of surveys in the last decade. So the people who have actually experienced it don't think it's a failure. I do not think it's a failure. I think it's generally produced substantial levels of interracial contact that have lasted reasonably well. I think that we do know ways to make it much better, and I think it has been unsuccessful in some cases, cases like Boston, for example. And I think we know why.
So what are the lessons to be learned from Boston?
Well, Boston was a plan that was implemented in total political conflict with a school district that was defying the court, a plan that was developed by state government, a plan that emphasized short-term busing between hostile communities that were close to one another, and a plan that involved very few middle-class students, since Boston is a small central city cut off from its suburban growth for many generations. So even though the greater Boston area has a small minority population and a very large middle-class population, it was implemented in a way that brought poor kids from different neighborhoods together in schools that didn't offer much additional advantage to either. With all the fears, exploited by politicians in a way that just drove up the political and social tension tremendously.
So you think it's important that the middle class always be included in desegregation plans?
I think that's where the principal advantage comes to for the minority students. And I also think it's very important for middle class whites to learn how to live in a society that is not all middle class whites if they're going to have success as adults in a really multiracial community. So I think it is. And in fact, most people don't realize that Boston's had a plan since 1965 called METCO, which has transported several thousand inner city kids out to suburban schools on a voluntary basis now for almost 30 years, which has been quite successful and for which there's a very large demand and which has not produced serious problems and has led many students to make successful educational connections.
You know the complaint of a lot of middle-class parents that they choose a neighborhood in part because of the school there, and then if there's the possibility that their child would be bused to a school in another neighborhood, they feel really cheated.
Well, we don't really have a society where some families should be able to buy a special level of services and protection that other families who are discriminated against the housing market or are poor will automatically get inferior education. That's not a very viable social structure. Now, I think middle-class families want to have their children in a predominantly middle-class school and one that's functioning and one that's providing educational opportunity. And they should have that. In fact, that's the kind of school that we should try to provide for as many students as possible. Almost all of our desegregation plans since the 1970s have not been simple, mandatory busing plans. We've had almost none of those adopted in a generation now. Almost all of them include lots of choice, magnet schools, special educational programs, and so forth, with less coercion and more educational options. So that many of the more contemporary desegregation plans involve positive advantage for middle-class parents by offering special curricula that can't be offered at every school in some schools where their students have a chance to attend and get something they couldn't possibly get in a neighborhood school system.
Are there other suggestions you have of ways to make desegregation plans better?
Well, I think that the absolutely central to effective desegregation is realizing that just getting the kids inside the school does not accomplish the purpose of producing equal opportunity. Getting the kids inside the front door of the school is unnecessary but far from sufficient condition for having equal opportunity. And really, there's a lot of things that need to be done inside the school in terms of moving beyond tracking by race, dealing with the tensions between different groups of students, helping kids understand each other's culture and background, the contributions to the society, and so forth. Those are the things that produce high benefits from desegregation, and we really haven't paid much attention to them as a society for a long time. There was a federal program that was enacted in the 1970s called the Emergency School Aid Act, which was designed to foster those kinds of changes inside schools voluntarily. It didn't pay for busing. Now, that program was the largest educational program in the federal budget that was zeroed out during the Reagan years. I think that was a tragic mistake in a multiracial society. You know, those problems are the problems that we should be thinking about very, very hard, how to make things actually work, how to build interracial communities, how to create respect and understanding. Those are really central questions for our society and for our future as a democracy.
My guest is Gary Orfield. He's the director of the Harvard Project on School Desegregation. And in December, they issued a report on the growth of segregation in American schools. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Gary Orfield, director of the Harvard Project on School Desegregation. I live in Philadelphia, and last month, a Pennsylvania state judge ruled that the Philadelphia School District hadn't done enough to desegregate its schools. And the judge ordered that a team of experts be organized to design a desegregation plan. Now, initially, the school district was going to appeal this ruling because the school district leaders said that it's impossible to desegregate Philadelphia schools because 75% of the students are Black or Latino. Therefore, you'd need to involve suburban schools in order to effectively integrate the Philadelphia schools. I should say here that the Philadelphia School District decided not to appeal this ruling, but to go along with it finally. So what are your impressions of the ruling and of the initial resistance to it?
Well, there was a committee appointed to examine the situation in Philadelphia, and which reported to the court that the court really needed to order desegregation there that would include suburban jurisdictions. But the judge who was in charge of the case rejected that advice and said that she would not require additional busing and so forth. And all of this was during a time when she was running for office. She's now ordered a plan to be developed that deals with educational inequities. I think that that she made a fundamental mistake on the first part. Really isolating Philadelphia from the middle-class communities around it really limits what can happen. And it's much like the Kansas City case where the judge dismissed the suburban parties and then tried to upgrade the schools by pouring money into them. And now, over $1 billion later, been relatively limited results and not very much desegregation at all. So I think it's a mistaken decision, and that it will prove to be very difficult to produce substantial reforms and educational gains in the city of Philadelphia within the constraints that the judges suggested.
Are there cities where the city schools have been integrated with students from the suburbs?
Yes, of course. There's lots of cities in the South that were parts of countywide school systems. Almost all of the major school districts in Florida include both the central city and its suburbs, for example. And many of them have had city suburban desegregation plans now for over 20 years that have produced very high levels of integration. And after the initial period have not produced substantial levels of white loss. In other words, they've maintained whites better than almost any of the central city or really large school districts in the country. There are in the city of Wilmington, which is not far from you, the city and suburban school districts were merged at the end of the 1970s, and the state of Delaware, as a result, became one of the most integrated states in the United States. And that's only, less than an hour's drive from Philadelphia, but the lessons didn't seem to penetrate up to Philadelphia. In the city of St. Louis, which was 75% African-American when it was ordered to desegregate in 1980, developed a series of magnet schools that are fairly well integrated inside the city and a transfer program under which about a fourth of the African-American students have chosen to transfer out to suburban school districts. Milwaukee has a smaller plan of that sort. Indianapolis was ordered to send students from the city out to suburbs without sending students from the suburbs back to the city. So there's a wide variety of approaches that have been experimented with over the last generation. And I think it's just simply wrong to say that there's nothing that can be done. There's no panacea, but there's lots of good things that can be done.
I think there are many African-American leaders today who say that it's more realistic and productive now to improve the quality of education in Black neighborhood schools than to just fixate on integration as the solution. I wonder what your reaction to that is.
I think it's very important to do everything we can to improve the quality of education for children wherever they are, and certainly it's true that You know, many African-American young people are in schools that are not likely to be integrated under the existing policies, and that we should do everything we can to help those schools. Now, those schools are typically high-poverty schools that are burdened with lots of problems, and they're in school districts that tend to have declining resources and also declining political power in their state governments. So it's a very, very serious and difficult thing. We also have very few models of improving high-poverty schools that have worked on a large scale. In the areas that I've studied, there's an extremely strong relationship between achievement levels and concentration of poverty. So we have a very hard challenge. We have to do everything we possibly can to do it, and we have to be much more tough-minded about it than we have been in the past. In terms of the leaders' attitudes and the people's attitudes, they're quite a bit different. There's been almost no change in the preference of African-American families for having integrated schools in the last generation. And in many cities where leaders said that it was not an issue, when the options were made available for students to transfer, there were many families who were interested in transferring. So just as it would be a mistake to say a white leader says such and such, therefore we don't have to worry about it anymore, it's a mistake to say that if a black leader says such and such, that means it's not an issue anymore. It can very well be an issue, but not for that particular politician.
In San Francisco, each integrated school must have at least four different ethnic groups represented. Can you describe that plan a little bit and tell us what you think of it?
Well, I'm working with the federal court in San Francisco, and I'll tell you a little bit about the plan that was developed by agreement between the NAACP, the state of California, and the San Francisco School District. Basically, under that plan, each school has at least some members of four different groups, and that none of the groups can be above can be a majority of any school. There's an effort to get to build in some multiracial characteristics into the school populations. The school system is incredibly diverse. The largest single group is Chinese, about a quarter of the students. Another quarter are other Asian groups, about 1/6 whites, blacks, and Latinos. So you've got a system that kind of foretells the most striking kind of diversity that one could imagine. And inside that system, a variety of different techniques are being used, magnet schools, student reassignments, all kinds of specialty programs. There was a use of a special device called reconstitution, where schools that were very unsuccessful in serving the needs of African-American students in a concentrated low-income African-American population were simply dissolved. Brand new schools were created a decade ago in which a new principal could recruit faculty from anywhere in the United States. Faculty had to be committed to certain principles of believing in the student's capacity to develop, and committed to certain principles of interracial schooling. Those schools have succeeded better than any other schools in the city in producing some actual gains for low-income minority young people.
So I wonder if that's almost a metaphor for what you think needs to be done in the American schools, to just kind of tear a lot of it down and start from scratch again.
Well, as I look at it, we have some syndromes and cycles of inequality that are kind of self-perpetuating and self-deepening over time, and that they take hold of schools and areas of cities in a way that makes it very difficult to change from the inside. We found by just pouring money into those schools, in San Francisco, for example, we got no results at all. We could put an extra $250,000 in for year after year and let the school do whatever plan it wanted, and we didn't get anything. So it seems to me that in some of these circumstances, the kind of loss of hope and the loss of vision and the burnout has become so serious that the only thing that has a chance is to try to build some new institutions inside of the old structures and to remake them from the inside.
Schools really have had to deal with all of the larger social problems in American society, segregation being just one of them. But I wonder if you think it's really possible for American schools to become integrated while the neighborhoods the students live in remain segregated.
Well, it's possible if the right kind of plan is done. Whether it's the best thing to do is another question. I think it's it's very clear that it would be much better for us to have more integrated neighborhoods where we could have naturally integrated schools where kids would go home from school to the same kind of diversity and same kind of contact with all the range of possibilities that they have in school. And I think we ought to be putting much more effort into that. One of the remarkable things about it is if you think since the Brown decision, we've had 40 years, and the average family moves every 6 years in this country. That means we've rebuilt all our segregated neighborhoods six or seven times over without any real serious effort to change them. And if we really had a serious effort to change that pattern, we might begin to really break down some of those severe barriers within a decade or two and begin to put more of the emphasis where it ought to have been from the beginning to build integrated communities which would be served by integrated schools rather than to just deal with one aspect of a young person's life.
Do you have children, and how did you deal with their schooling?
Well, my kids went to school primarily in the Washington, D.C., Chicago public schools, and then last one and graduated from the Cambridge school system, all of which were highly integrated, and all of them did very, very well and had, I think, rich experiences.
Public schools?
Yes.
And did they ever, were they ever bused to another neighborhood? Or?
Yes, all of them were bused.
Really? And what did they think of it?
They liked it. Mm-hmm. They were bused primarily in the city of Champaign, where we went to the Booker T. Washington School, and it was a very fine, upbeat school with a wonderful attitude. And the actual studies of kids and buses is that kids find buses a pretty nice way to go to school. They get to talk to their friends on the way to school every morning. Kids do not see busing as a big burden.
Gary Orfield directs the Harvard Project on School Desegregation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.